Good afternoon. Welcome to part two of today, Tuesday, the 15th of September, which is publication day for a number of authors, one of whom is Wendy Walker, whom we're delighted to welcome to the Poison Pen. We don't actually have a copy of her new book, Don't Look for Me, because Wendy has been autographing them at home and sending them to the Poison Pen. But Megan and Wendy, you can each hold up a copy, right? There it is. Don't Look for Me. So we'd be delighted to sell you one, and I certainly hope that you will consider buying one as a nice gesture of support for the authors, and a thank you for spending time with us this afternoon. So Megan Miranda, we still have a few copies over there of The Widow, where are they? The Girl from Widow Hill. Yes, there it is. Right. An absolutely wonderful book. We were fortunate enough to talk to Megan when her book published earlier, and we still have a very few signed copies, first prints of her book. So Megan, you're going to be the host today, so I'm delighted to sit back and pick up my schnapple. I only wish it were wine, and let you take over and talk to Wendy.
Yes, thank you. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having us, and hi, Wendy, congratulations.
Hi, it's so great to see you. It's
like, you too. I'm so excited to celebrate with you and to chat with you because, you know, I've been a longtime fan. I've loved all of your thrillers and I always look forward to them coming out. I think because, you know, there are these really fast paced, twisty reads, but they also have such emotional depth and you really dig into the character relationships and the family dynamics. And so I'm really excited to talk with you about this new one in particular, which I actually think might be like your fastest. I mean, I could not put it down. I think I read it in about a day and a half. You just, once you start, you can't really put it down. So I wondered if we could just start with you giving us sort of a little summary of what the book's about for people who haven't read it yet.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you so much for saying that. I'm a huge fan of yours, as you know. So Don't Look for Me is a story of Molly Clark. She's a wife and mother, and she disappears in a small town a couple of hours away from where she lives. And soon after the search begins, they conclude that she's walked away from her life. And there are reasons behind that. She has suffered a terrible loss. The whole family has in the death of a child 5 years before. And a lot of things were spiraling out of control for her emotionally. And then they find a note that basically says, you'll be better off without me. And she doesn't want to be found. 2 weeks later, her daughter, Nicole, who's 21 and whose life has also unraveled since the death of her sister, she gets a call from a woman who tells her that she saw her mother get into a truck, and this is a new lead. And so Nicole decides to go back to the town, which is a very economically depressed, eerie sort of mid-state town by the river, by herself to look for her mother, and she's determined to find her. Even if she's walked away from her life, she's going to find her at all cost. And so the story is about these two women, mother and daughter. It's written in two narrations with a split time frame. So it's not a traditional missing person book where you don't know where the person is. You know where Molly is all of the time. You're with her in first person, hour by hour, day by day. And then you're also with Nicole 2 weeks later as she begins this desperate search for her mother. And eventually the time frames converge and there's the big reveal, many reveals towards the end. And so it's a book that's meant to be fast paced and page turning, but there is a lot of emotional firepower in the book as well.
There is. It really lingers with you for so long after. And I think it really is the depth of these two main characters. And since you mentioned them, I want to talk a little bit more about them because I'm so fascinated by the way you explored this mother-daughter dynamic and how you can see these different events from both their perspective, not only in their present storylines, but also in how they viewed what happened in the past and how the guilt and grief has impacted both of their lives and the choices they're making. And also, I think because of the narrative structure, you feel like you're with Nick, you know, searching for her mother, like chasing, it's almost like one storyline is chasing after the other one. Mm-hmm. And I'm so curious, first of all, how you were thinking about these two narrators and also how you came up with the structure for this book. Was that always how it kind of came to you in your mind?
So in terms of the two women, I really wanted to write strong women. So these are not damsels in distress. These are women, they actually had a really healthy, happy family until the accident occurred that took the youngest child. And the nature of the accident, and it was truly an accident, but as with all accidents, you know, you look at ways you could have prevented it if you had done something differently. Both Molly, the mother, and Nicole, the sister, daughter, feel a sense of responsibility for that accident. And they have not been able to move through the guilt to then process the grief. And they've been stuck. And I refer to them in the book as the bow and stern of a sinking ship. And what I tried to do in the book was when this incident happens, which has nothing to do, you know, with their, you know, who they are and being, you know, victims, they find themselves in this terrible situation and they both get their fight on. And Molly is fighting first for her freedom. And there's no physical violence, there's no sexual violence, there's no torture, but she fears that she will never be able to break free of where she's being held. And so she fears for her freedom, and she is eventually fearful for her daughter when she learns that she's come back to this town to look for her where the danger lies. So she gets her fight on within her captivity, and Nicole gets her fight on when she makes this, in the first chapter you meet her and she gets this call, and you know, they've got it, private investigator looking for Molly, they've got a reward out. But all the tips that have been coming in have been dismissed as quacks and, you know, just seeking the money. And this woman bypasses the police and is able to get to Nicole. And so it's the first time she's heard of a lead, and something switches on in her because she knows if she doesn't find her mother, she'll never be able to make things right and make the family whole again. And she realizes she wants that. So their emotional sort of fervor and fight is really powerful. And that's what I was trying to get across. So writing the split time frame, I've used this technique in another book because I wanted it to be a page turner. I didn't want it to get bogged down in all of this emotion. It's a thriller. I wanted people to have that thrill and the page turning quality. By doing a split time frame, you can create what I call the monster in the closet feeling, where the reader always knows something that the character does not. So if you know there's a monster in the closet and your character is walking around the room and has no idea, it doesn't matter what that character does. The character could just walk around, you know, reading a book, and you are filled with suspense because you're wondering when she's going to discover the monster, if the monster is going to jump out. You know, I mean, it's just mechanical. So that technique really lends itself to creating that tension between the chapters, which alternate. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to combine that with the emotional intensity to give that feeling. And it's so interesting. I was having this discussion with the audio performer, Therese Plummer, who's brilliant. If you like the audiobook, I was able to interview her, and we did like a promotional video together, and she's wonderful. But we were talking about the different types of storytelling, and especially during this time when everybody's anxiety is so high, there is something powerful about being able to feel all of these emotions in a safe place, because fear and sadness and anxiety and all these feelings that you can experience in a book or even a television show, you don't have to do anything about it. You don't have to save Molly. You don't have to save Nick. It's not on you. So you can feel those feelings and let them out of your body in a way that's sort of safe. And it's really a powerful escape. If a medium of entertainment can make you feel.
That is such a fascinating way. I mean, I hadn't thought about it, and you're totally right. And you're sort of, you're taking the journey through, you're experiencing it, and you're making it to the other side. And it is this sort of outlet of being able to experience all those emotions. And you do such an incredible job of tying him to both of those elements of these strong emotional connections and this super fast pace. And I love that analogy of the monster in the closet, because that's exactly how I felt when I was reading the book. You're like, don't go in there, or you're getting closer. You could just feel her getting closer and you knew it was dangerous. So I loved it so much. So one of the things I'm fascinated about hearing from other writers is kind of the genesis of an idea. I know some people start with characters, some with a plot idea. So I wondered if you could tell us a little about where this idea started for you.
So this is the first book that actually started with an event, like a moment in my life. I definitely draw from, you know, general experience and my work as a family law attorney and just being a mother and all these things. We draw from those, right? As writers, we draw from our life experience. But this book started with an actual moment. I was at a gas station 2 hours from home, coming back from watching my son's sporting event, just like Molly. I wrote the chapter to mirror my experience because I wanted to capture that. And it was just a time in my life when I had a high level of anxiety because just the things that were going on in my life. And I had also just had a really bad day. So I had this, you know, drove 4 hours by myself to watch my son play varsity soccer. And anybody who has a child who plays, you know, in high school sports, games can get rough. I mean, there are some games that just get under your skin. The kids are heckling and being cruel and the ref calls are bad. And it's just, you can't do anything about it. You feel powerless as a parent. And I was driving home alone. He was with the team on the bus, 4 hours home, and all these thoughts were spinning. And there was nothing I could do. I couldn't like do the laundry or go for a run. I'm stuck, you know, driving through the middle of Connecticut, which is this, you know, it's a double lane road, not a highway. And just the emotions were spinning and spinning and spinning, of feeling powerless as a parent. My whole life feeling like I was dedicated to my kids and I couldn't, and I can't protect them from the world, and just the meaning of life and like how all these things, you know, you go down these rabbit holes, plus the heightened level of anxiety I was already experiencing. And I was pumping gas at this gas station and I saw this road that went off up and down hills, but just it disappeared into the horizon, flanked by the cornfields. And this flash of a thought came through my brain, just to walk down the road. Like that it was like, I want to walk down that road. And then, you know, of course I didn't do that. But then the rest of the way home, being a writer, I grabbed hold of that. I'm like, where did that come from? Is there something behind it? Have other people felt it? And could it be a book? And what I found is that that thought is actually referred to as emotional hijacking or amygdala hijacking, which is a term that I hadn't come across even with all my other research for my other books. And it's when the emotional part of your brain gets so activated that it just completely overpowers and doesn't even give the rational side a chance to weigh in on the thought or the decision. And it comes from our fight or flight instinct, which is very primitive. And there's, you know, it's very useful. Like if a lion's coming at you, you don't want to have like an internal, you know, discussion in your head about whether you should run or not. You want to act. So, you know, it's a useful part of our biology, but when it's being activated by emotion, you do want the rational part to come in and take hold and say, okay, you know, you don't need to walk down the road and walk away from your life because your son had a bad soccer game. Like, let's just take a breath here. But the research showed that, first of all, most missing person cases are the result of a walk away situation. The vast majority. And many of them are, you know, based on rational thought, either an abusive situation or somebody just skipping town on debt or whatever, but it's a thought out plan. But a lot of them are the result of an emotional hijacking that does not get resolved, that it's so great, it completely hijacks and the rational brain doesn't have a chance to step in before that person acts. And so when I learned those two things, I knew I had to write this story, and I knew it had to start at that gas station and that it had to be that kind of town. And I just wanted to capture everything that I'd been feeling because I could picture it. I could picture it. So I put Molly there and gave her an enormous amount of emotional turmoil to create that hijacking situation. And then she walks down the road, but by the time she comes to her senses, of course, then it's too late. And she takes a ride to get back to safety and of course doesn't make it. But so it actually started with like, it's the first time this has ever happened where I had a real life moment that I then, you know, grew into a book.
But I think that's what makes, I mean, that's fascinating. I love that story. And I think that's what makes you able to really connect with these characters so well. I think a lot of, you know, this character-driven psychological suspense is sort of taking these situations that we can almost imagine and then bringing them to an extreme, like an extreme of emotion, or how many steps could it take you to get to the place where you do walk down that road? So that's absolutely riveting. And so thinking about that, and you touched a little bit on this with the psychology of this, and I feel like this is a theme in several of your books. I feel like there's always this really interesting psychological component to your characters. From, you know, All Is Not Forgotten and The Night Before, you really delve into these. And so I'm wondering, is there, you know, research that you do specifically for these books? Is this kind of how you approach your characters in general when you're imagining them and breathing them into existence?
Yeah, So All Is Not Forgotten definitely was born out of this curiosity with memory science. And I really enjoy writing characters who have actual like diagnosable issues that are grounded in real psychology. And I think that comes from the training I got when I was practicing family law. I had some training in these sociopathic illnesses, narcissism, and borderline personality disorder, and all, you know, they're on like this whole spectrum, and I find them fascinating. And I also find the genesis of them fascinating, which it often starts in early childhood. And I just love diving into those issues, and by finding a real psychological issue that I can explain through a backstory, I think that also helps those characters become more relatable and understandable, even if they're bad actors in the story, even if they're unreliable narrators, or they're, you know, they end up doing bad things, but just to understand where it came from. And it's not just out of the blue, because sociopathic behavior it really is on a spectrum, and there is debate over whether it's, you know, nature or nurture, but many arguments weigh in favor of the nurture part of it. And that's where you can build a backstory that can tie into the character and just add so much more depth, I think, to a book.
I did not know there were arguments that it was more nurture than nature. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, they say, you know, there's I think some you know, researchers believe that there are things that make you susceptible to it, but it's basically a lack of empathy. That's what runs through the entire spectrum, from just mild borderline personality disorder or mild narcissism to serial killing, like psychopaths, however you want to describe them. But the main component is a lack of empathy, and there are different degrees of that, but empathy is something that we develop in really early childhood, the first 3 years of life, actually. And the thing that makes research difficult is that people don't have a memory of that, and if their parents or their caregivers were neglectful or abusive, they're very unlikely to, you know, reveal that in a case study. So it's very difficult to know what happened to these people who are have these illnesses and are studied in those first 3 years of life. But it's fascinating. I find psychology fascinating, which is why I always have to pull stuff out because I always write, I always end up writing too much. That's been a balancing act. But I think this one, there's not much in it in terms of the psychology. There's no psychologist describing it. You sort of just have to feel it.
Yeah, you definitely feel it. And I think that about your whole cast of characters too, you really feel the different layers to them. And so this kind of ties into my next question, which is a little more about writing process, because I suspected pretty much every character at some point in this book. And so I wonder, like, do you know from the start what happened, and do you plot that out before you start? Are you very meticulous, or do you kind of write your way in and figure things out as you go?
I do plot. I know we've had this discussion before, because I always forget that you're not a plotter because you went to MIT, and I'm always like, she has to be a plotter. I know she is. And then you're like, no, I'm a pantser. It always surprises me when we have this discussion. But I plot mostly just so I can face the blank screen and not have an anxiety attack over what has to go into that chapter. But also maybe this is from, being a lawyer, and really my writing training comes from writing for the law, which is mm-hmm. really piecing together in a brief or anything that you're writing, really is telling a story, but you have to piece together the facts and the law and all of the arguments that go into it. So that's where my writing brain is. So when I go to sit down to write, I just want to know what has to happen in that chapter. And so I see the whole plot as like almost like a Jenga tower. These are all the pieces that have to go into place to build up to the moments of suspense. And so that, like you said, so you will suspect each person. Where can I add something to suspect this? So you'll suspect this character, but then now doubt the evidence, but now believe the evidence. And now another character maybe has lied, but is that lie relevant? And all of those have to be woven in organically. You don't want a data dump in one chapter. And so I always plot out the chapter. Like in this chapter, I want Nick to meet this character and find out that this person may have been lying. And the rest of it will be, the creative process, and it always changes. So in this case, I think the first draft, there was a whole other character who was involved, and there was a different motive, and it changed. But I always knew who the captor was, and I knew the twist that was going to happen with, almost near the ending. And the main thing is that I knew what was going on in that house with Molly. That I knew. And so those chapters were rarely changed. Nicole's chapters were trickier. And I know you must find this when you're writing. There's usually a character who's finding out most of the stuff that has to be, found out to solve the crime. And it's hard. Those chapters are hard because you don't want it to, you need to write it in a sort of organic way that the reader doesn't feel like they're just being clunked over the head with a piece of evidence. So yeah, so that's for me, that's where the plotting really helps.
Yeah. So did you then, when you were writing it, did you write it in the order it's read, or did you do one character first and kind of stay in theirs and then do the other? I'm always so curious. These are like my nosy writer questions.
No, it's great. And you know what? A lot of writers are asking me that question, and it never occurred to me to write one narration all the way through and then write the other one, because for me, there's that the interplay between the two chapters always. So at the end of each chapter, you learn something new, and then you go to the next character, and you want that character to now know that. So you recreate the monster in the closet. So, Nicole finds something out in one chapter, and then you go to Molly, who experiences something that is a clue. She doesn't know, you know, she's not experiencing it as a clue, but you are as the reader. Then you go back to Nicole with this new information, and now there's another monster in the closet that you're like, oh my gosh, she needs to find that out. When is she going to find that out? So, but that for me sometimes will change, because sometimes I'll be writing and I'll think of a zinger to put in, and then that has to play into the next chapter. So if I wrote it all continuously, I don't think I would get as much texture between an interplay between the two narrations.
Yeah, no, that's my instinct would be to write it in the order that it's read as well. But I do know people who've written just kind of stay in that voice. But I like that idea of, you know, you leave with a cliffhanger and then you get to the next piece of information and it feels a little more like a puzzle that you're continuing together. Yeah. So I actually had a question about the place, because it feels almost symbolic as well. It kind of goes in, it ties very closely, I think, to, you know, it's almost like a place that feels like it's been forgotten, or, you know, it is this place where you can disappear and there's these roads that lead to places that, you know, aren't really necessarily well-traveled or mapped out. So is this based on a real place, or is this, I mean, other than I know you stopped at the gas station, is that the actual town, or was this something that you created?
So there, it's a fictional town, but it's very much based on, you know, sort of all of the towns that I have driven through and passed over my many, many years living in Connecticut and driving to games, driving up to colleges to visit, driving anytime, going to ski, going up to Vermont to ski. So anytime that you want to go through central Connecticut, which is a small state, then most people have no idea what it looks like, but along the coast are two highways, but go, and then way over to the west is the New York state thruway. But in the middle of Connecticut, there's just one main road, Route 7, that takes you straight up through to Western Mass and then all the way up to Vermont. And there's a ton of boarding schools and colleges and then, you know, ski resorts. So people in my area drive it a lot. So it's well traveled. And so there are these little spots that have grown to service people who are traveling through, gas stations, mini marts. And they are strategically placed. It's almost, you know, like 2 hours is kind of when people get a little fidgety and want to stop. It's amazing. And I wrote that in, that, you know, that this is the place she always stops when she goes to visit her son at his boarding school. And those places do exist. The town, the thing about these towns, that they run along a river. So this, the main road was built because there's a river that is next to it. And I did some research on that. And, you know, rivers years ago, before there were really good roads, were often used for transportation for factories and also for waste dumping before they had the EPA and all of that. So there've been a lot of cleanup actions along the Housatonic River. But as a result, you know, the factories and industry that used to thrive because of this river no longer found the river useful, and they moved closer to the highways, and they moved out of these towns, and they left these towns really just completely abandoned. And there are no trains that run there. You know, you might be able to catch a bus, but it's not a commuting vehicle. So the cities, there are no cities that you can get to without driving for a couple of hours. And so they really just got left hung out to dry economically. And as a result, anytime there's an economic downturn, they get hit the hardest. And the people who have stayed there tend to be, very few people move there, right? Nobody's going to go move there for a job, or, you know, because of, you know, it's economically advantageous. So the people who are there tend to be there because that's where they grew up, and they meet, you know, then they get married and they have kids and they stay there. So what's so great about that is it's insular, mm-hmm. and everybody knows everybody's business. going back generations. So it's not that, not just that you know your peer group and your age group, but you know their kids, their mother, their grandmother, everybody knows everybody's business. And as a result, there are so many secrets and motivations and things to play with as an author. So I wanted to create that, the atmosphere physically of the cornfields and the you know, the rundown houses, but also of that feeling of everybody knowing everybody else. And that's what, you know, that's the first time I've actually built in a town as almost a character in one of my books. And it served a really great purpose.
I absolutely love those small town settings. Just like you were saying, I feel like there's just so much you can do with that in a place where everybody knows everything about one another, or they think they know everything right about each other. And, you know, what are you willing to tell? There is sort of the dynamic of insider versus outsider as well, because Nicole is an outsider to this town when she's coming in. So you do get that feeling of, do they even want to tell her things, you know, like, yeah, what secrets are, what are they protecting, and do they even trust this person? And they've already run an investigation and didn't find her mother, and they believe she walked away. So I found that just so interesting, and it did feel very much like a character in and of itself. And another thing I loved was this idea of witnesses and what people see and what they piece together from what they see. And so, you know, there are several different angles to that. There's the note that she leaves behind and what you see in that. And it's also the witness who sees Molly walking down the road and you know, raising her arm or raising
her handbag. Yeah.
Yes. And what somebody sees in that, but what Nicole reads into that are very different things. So can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah. So I was, you know, when you're piecing together all of these moments that you want to ring true, but are also going to be crucial to a plot twist down the road, and that, you know, things like that. So the note, you know, was found at a nearby hotel, at a casino, small casino, which Connecticut has these like little, they're not that little, but they're, you know, casinos that have cropped up. And so I wanted to create that little environment, which is like half an hour from this town. And then the moment, you know, what the witness sees, it's a rainy night, there's a hurricane that night. And, you know, and it, I
very
wanted
much like this.
Yeah, very much like that. And there's the, you know, and I wanted it to be something that could be picked apart. Mm-hmm. So this is a woman who comes forward 2 weeks later because she says she's not from there. She's from out of town, and she just heard about the case. And she, you know, like heard from a friend, oh my gosh, wait, I was there. I saw a woman get in a truck. And yet there's the reward money. So what's her motive? And so then when Nicole goes and the local cop is, they're interviewing this woman, and they're able to pick apart all these little things in her testimony. Like, how could you really see when that much rain? And so they, you know, they recreate it and they start questioning her about, well, could you really see that far, you know, away? Are you sure this is where you were and you were facing this direction? Why were you heading out of town? You know, so all of these things then become clues. She saw the broken headlight or taillight. And then what Molly does, there had to be something distinctive that she knew that was going to be so unique to Molly that Nicole believes the story. And that was when she raises her handbag. And the handbag was bright orange, and it has the initials of all three children, even the one who died. And it's something that Nicole and her brother are always embarrassed about, you know, that she does it after, you know, when she's trying to get their attention. And so it's a very distinctive gesture that not, you know, that wouldn't be something that you could look up on Google, something that only a family member would know.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I can tell listening to that that you've had plenty of experience with eyewitnesses. And, no, I'm serious. I used to practice law too, and that is always one of the, you know, difficulties is what people think they saw. And memory plays into it and so forth. So it's very complicated. And I'm really glad you mentioned the weather, because the hurricane was such an important part of this story. So, you know, it's situational in the sense that she might have been predictable driving, but you couldn't predict a hurricane. So I like that when, you know, some cosmic event, so to speak, completely unexpected or predictable event occurs and warps what's happening. So Patrick has joined me. Let me just check with him and see, do you have any questions or comments over here? No, it's okay. Go ahead and read them, and then we'll go back to wherever we were. We were kind of at a stopping point.
No problem. Okay, guys, here's a question for both of you, which is, and you've touched on this a little bit, but do you start with character or do you start with plot? Does one grow naturally out of the other? I think I know the answer, but we'll see.
You take it first, Megan. I've been talking.
I love this question, and I feel like we've probably talked about this before as well. For me, I always pretty much start with character before plot. I'm not somebody who sees the big plot right off the bat. I could have an idea for a situation or, you know, a setting that goes hand in hand, but it really, really comes from the character. And I have to write my way into the story to get to know what their relationships are like. And so I feel like the plot almost forms in opposition to who my main character is, because I think about what they're afraid of, and maybe not, you know, the big external, like, what are our fears, but, you know, is there something in your past you don't want exposed? You know, things like that, or do you fear not being taken seriously? And so I feel like the plot in many levels develops in opposition to that character, and they really develop side by side for me. And because I don't do a lot of drafting up front, unfortunately, I have to do a lot of work in the revision process once I figure things out. Like when we were talking about red herrings and, you know, putting suspicion on people, my red herrings are because when I'm the main character writing from their point of view, I do not trust anyone because I have no idea who did it. So, like, I feel like I can connect to that emotion of distrust and uncertainty. And so I channel that into the first draft. And then when I figure things out, I have to really pull back and place everything. But I'd say for me, it's very much character first. How about you?
So this book started with, I guess, with the character, but also the situation that she was in. And I'm trying to think if I started, if I've ever started with just a character. Situation. I'm like, it's situation. It's and then the characters grow out of the situation for me. So Emma in the Night, the first curiosity for me was, what would it be like to have disappeared and come back years later? Mm-hmm. And why would you come back? And what if you, and then I thought, okay, that's interesting. So how old would this person be? And then I thought, well, what do I want the story to be? And I wanted it to be about family dysfunction. I wanted there to be a narcissistic mother. I wanted to write that. But it really started with that concept. All Is Not Forgotten started with memory science and the you know, the real life science of working on techniques to alter memory of trauma. And I wanted to examine that. And that's, everything grew out of that desire. Every character was constructed and every situation was constructed to push that that sort of issue, that moral dilemma, to its absolute limits. And then the character telling the story was the character who had to be telling the story, because he's the only person who could know everybody's secrets. And so that's how he was born, but was out of the plot. And the Night Before, the same thing. It started with the concept of, you know, of deception in internet dating, and two sisters. And and then this one really was, the character again grew out of the situation. I knew it had to be, for someone to have that kind of emotional distress, and to be at a point in life where you would have an impulse to walk away, I knew I had to give her a lot of life history. So she had to be an adult, probably with a family, and then a mother, because one, you know, I asked the question, what is the worst thing I could do to my to this character? Losing a child, and then feeling responsible for the loss of the child. And so then Molly was born from the need to have those elements in place. You know, so hearing, that's so interesting. We write completely different. Cancer character first, and I'm a plotter with concept first, and yet we both come out with really similar psychological suspense that I think are, you know, have a lot of things in common. It's so interesting.
I love hearing the different process, but also hearing you talk, I sort of started to doubt myself. I was like, maybe I am a situation, maybe it is hand in hand, because I do feel like some of it is, you know, the character and the situation go a little bit hand in hand. So, you know, when the Girl from Widow Hill is very much like a character was the center of a huge media story when they were growing up. And that was, so yeah, I was doubting
myself. And I was going to say that when we talked, because I interviewed you for the Girl from Widow Hills, and I was fascinated by the situation that was, you know, somebody who had this fame from a terrible incident, and we talked about baby Jessica,
right?
And what would happen? What would baby Jessica be like now? And so that's a little of both, because baby, you know, that is a character first, but it's also a very specific situation.
Yeah. So I think sometimes it is a little more blended, but yeah, now I'm thinking a little more about this. It's a great question.
Very good question.
Well, another kind of along the same lines, do you both find that your antenna are always up and twitching for new stories and situations? And do they ever come from unlikely places? Do you ever hear like a little fragment that you say, aha, that's very interesting. I'm going to use that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, definitely for me, 100%. And sometimes these ideas sit in the back of your mind for a while, and maybe they don't trigger that story idea right away. But there is, like, I can point to those moments where the antenna goes up where I'm like, aha. And definitely for the Girl from Widow Hills, I think we had talked about this, Wendy. I was listening to a news program a long time ago, and I heard this snippet that said something like, baby Jessica's getting married. And I said, baby Jessica, I haven't heard that name in decades, but I could just remember in an instant that story, even though I was a child when it happened. But nothing really like triggered, like, this is a story I'm going to write. And then it was a few summers ago during the Thai cave rescue, when I felt myself being so invested in this story in the audience, and then started to think about, okay, what if somebody didn't want to be part of a story like this? And so it kind of triggered, you know, that memory of what I had heard years ago, and kind of all started taking off from there. But definitely I'll hear things. Sometimes I write them down. Sometimes, you know, I have this file where I'll look back through and things make no sense to me now, some of them, but some of them are things that really lingered with me. And then I find myself going back and a lot of times pulling various threads and creating a story from there.
Yeah, I definitely keep notes. I have my pile of scribbles, and I actually went and put them in a Word document last year. But now I can't find it on my computer. So I'm back to my, like, I'm glad I saved the scribbles. I get ideas. I will get them in the middle of the night. I'll wake up with an idea and I'll dictate it into my phone, sometimes about the book I'm working on, but sometimes about just a concept. And, you know, two strangers walk into a bar kind of thing. All the time. I mean, everywhere I am, every place I go, people I meet. And it's not that I'm looking, it's just that I've learned that if I notice something, and one example that I've given before is, you know, we go to a lot of cocktail parties at our schools. Well, we used to, right? You go to these gatherings like curriculum night or the class cocktail party, and people come as couples, and people, you know, a lot of, especially when kids are in high school, they've been married a long time. And I remember being at one, and, you know, usually the couples just, the women go to one corner, the men go to another corner, and that's it. And there's not a lot of you know, it's really like going back to high school yourself, like the boys and girls separate. But there was this one couple that were so affectionate, and I know them. I mean, I know they're, you know, they're very happily married, but it was just so, it was just like, oh, like he brought her a drink and gave her this affectionate kiss. It wasn't inappropriate, but it was just, I was like, whoa. Most of the time you would just let that pass. But as a writer, I've learned to put that in my file. Mm-hmm. So husband and wife, you know, are, you know, sort of unusually happy at this stage of their marriage, you know, and still affectionate and in love, and what could be behind that that's nefarious. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I'm always on the lookout for things like, and anything, if I'm noticing it, mm-hmm. then it, that means it's out of place and unusual. And that means that other people will find it to be the same, most people. And so there's a possible story there. That's how I look at almost everything.
And I can also tell, like, you know, you definitely, like, I think you have that thriller writer mind where you're taking the situation and you're like, and what dark thing can be hiding in there? I'm always doing the same. Like, I take this happy thing and they're like, sharp left turn.
Right. Oh no, I was running. I was out like running along a track there's a school across the street, and I was running, and there's a little wooded area, and there was just a plastic bag, you know, that from the garbage. And I'm, you know, I'm just out for a run. And the first thing I think of is, someone could be killed with a plastic bag, you know, like asphyxiation. And you kind of scare yourself sometimes. But
mind of the thriller writer.
I know. But that's why when you go, like when we go to our thriller conferences, I feel like we let loose because, and I was saying this earlier today to someone else, that because we have this thing, I don't know if we had it or we just have it now that we're thriller writers, but when we're all together and we don't have to worry about what people think of us, that we're not, you know, that really you thought that plastic bag was going to kill someone. Like it's like unfiltered conversation. And it's so funny. It's like, it's just unbelievable. Like a fly on the wall at a thriller conference would, you know, be a good spot to be.
Yes.
I often think talking to writers that what distinguishes writers from the rest of the world is the what if question, that mm-hmm. writers look at things and they go, what if, rather than just going by it. And you probably hone that when you write, as you write, you probably, that question, you know, comes to mind much more often.
Yeah.
That would be my guess.
Yeah, definitely.
Patrick, anything else?
Yeah, just had a good question come in, which is, I guess for both of you, which is, do you have any books brewing about the psychological effects of the pandemic or quarantine? It's
That's
the inevitable
thing
everybody yeah. have to face.
What do you think?
So, I mean, for me, I feel like I'm too close to it. Like, to me, I want to read something to escape that right now. And so I think it would have to be a while before I would write something about that. Although, I mean, there will definitely be ideas that kind of pop into my mind where I'm like, maybe one day, but not right now. But I did find I was working on a draft during this process, and it was a little bit it's set in a small neighborhood, a small close-knit neighborhood. And I definitely felt kind of those emotions kind of coming out even more where the boundaries were pulling tighter and tighter on this group of people. And it became a little more insular in nature. And so I think it definitely maybe affected thematically things I was working on, but I wouldn't say that I'm kind of approaching like I want to write a book that's set in quarantine or about the aftermath of quarantine. That's not like a plot point, but I do think just the experience of writing during that time, those elements probably made their way in kind of organically. How about you?
Yeah, I agree. Somebody also asked if I would write in the impact of it in terms of daily life. Mm-hmm. So if my next book will have people wearing masks and I said, absolutely not. I'm not doing that because I am very optimistic that we are going to, again, live in a world where we are not wearing masks. And so unless I am specifically writing about this time period, it would be a time, and it would be a time period, like it would be a plot point. It would be set here. It would be about the pandemic, or the pandemic would be crucial to the plot. Otherwise, no. I mean, I'm just writing, assuming we're going back to normal life at some point, because whatever I'm writing now won't come out for a couple of years anyway. And I'm optimistic that it would also date the book. So it would be like writing, I don't know, a book that was, you know, had women wearing big shoulder pads and scrunchies, and you're like, oh, 1980s, 1990s, you know. So I wouldn't want to date my work that way, but I have no plans of writing a plot point that involves the pandemic. I feel like that lends itself to maybe a political thriller or something, you know, but for my purposes, it doesn't really, I haven't thought about anything along those lines.
And if you wrote it now, when we have no idea how it's going to come out, anything you wrote possibly wrong.
Yes.
So,
I the emotional impact. I do agree with that I've definitely been, my heightened level of anxiety has definitely come out in my thinking about plots, for sure.
Well, I think Patrick sat back down, so that must be the extent of the questions. Megan, is there anything that you have not yet asked that you wish to ask?
I think we got everything. If I've loved chatting with you. I didn't know if you could tell us a little bit about what you might be working on.
Yeah. Now. So, it's been a really interesting year. The pandemic hit right when I was about to write a new novel, and I ended up writing it just out of sheer determination, like at 4 a.m. Like all my kids had moved back home, and I was waking up with anxiety, and I ended up writing something. I have not gone back to look at it. It has a character that I love. I don't think the form it's in now is the form it needs to be in, but I love this character. And so as soon as I'm done with all of the promoting and kids are back in school and like everything, you know, I have time again to focus, I'm going to take a breath and see if that character can be worked into a book. And actually that was the first, That is a book that I started with character, actually. It's a younger character, and I thought about her in a bar in the middle of Pennsylvania after drinking 2 Cosmos. So I don't know where that's gonna go, but a song was playing. It brought me back to a point in my life. And an emotional reaction I had, it was really visceral. And I was like, I want to write this person. I want to write this character. So I built a plot for her. But I call that my pandemic book. I don't know what will happen with it. But what's coming out next is actually coming out in 2 weeks. And it's an Audible original. I know. So the Audible, which is the audiobook company, they have started to produce original works. And they're short. Written by, you know, authors that most people know. And they're about a quarter of the length of a book. And so they're about 2 hours to listen to. And you sort of write them in a way that will lend itself to a 2-hour audio read, which was a whole other process. I had to listen to a bunch of them, and it's all very different. There's no middle. And that, you know, it was actually amazing, because you know how we always complain about the middle of the book? There's no middle. You're just like, you're like, oh, I gotta end the book because it's done. It was so amazing to be able to do that. But what I ended up doing, for a long time, I've had this idea of writing Dr. Forrester from All Is Not Forgotten. He's the narrator in my first thriller. And a very good friend of mine a couple years ago was saying, you know, I would love to see a book with him in it a few years later. Where does he find himself a few years later? And that's been brewing and brewing and brewing. And I came up with a twist and an idea for him But it's, you know, it's a hard sell to go back to. It's not going to be a series. It's just going to be what, another one-off. Like, it's hard to sell that to you know, a publisher and say, I'm just going to bring him back for one book. Like, it's, you know, I write standalones. So I wrote him. I wrote him. It was like, and I brought in the character from my pandemic book. She makes an appearance in the book in a way that I could still use her for other things. And it's called Hold Your Breath. It's coming out October 1st. It was the most joyous writing experience I've had in recent memory because I love writing Dr. Forster. I didn't have to write the middle. And I got to bring in this character from my pandemic book who I love. And I wrote it, you know, it was just seamless. It was joyful. So that that got written over the summer and it's coming out October 1st. And it has the same narrator, Dylan Baker, as All Is Not Forgotten, who's a wonderful character actor and voice performer. And so there's continuity there. So I'm extremely excited for that. Yeah.
That's so wonderful.
How about you? What do you have cooking, Megan?
Oh, well, I just finished, I'm in the middle of editing, so I should have a new suspense out next summer. Too soon to say, like, because I'm still editing, I don't want to say too much, but it's back to focusing on two women with a very complicated dynamic at the heart of the story. They had been roommates, and it's set in a small neighborhood where a crime has occurred. And that is all I'll say for now, but it should be out next summer.
I love it.
So this was so fun. Thank you so much.
It was really, really fun. Thank you for having me on. And thank you everybody for watching and supporting independent bookstores. It's such a wonderful thing. And thank you for having all of the authors that you've been having on. Without you and local libraries, we would have absolutely no access to our readers other than social media. We wouldn't have this ability to reach out and you know, answer questions and virtually meet readers. So thank you.
Well, you are welcome. And without you, we would have a harder time connecting with our customers. And we've just let back in the bookstore yesterday by appointment. So, you know, we're excited to see them and they've been very excited to watch you. I've been extremely impressed with the volume of their attendance. You know, it's really been remarkable how that audience has grown. So I'm really, it's been wonderful. We've always operated this way. It's just that right now we don't have people in the store, but we found the other day a cache of videotapes and realized our very first event like this was in 1995 with P.D. James.
Wow.
No kidding. So, you know, my husband has now converted those to audio. And we have the video, and so we have this enormous treasure trove of tapes that we're going to be able to bring forward. But it was a real shock to discover how long we'd been doing it, 25 years. Wow. So, you know, the pandemic for us has really been sort of the same. But where it's been fun is to bring together authors that would not be feasible if you were traveling. It wouldn't be economically or geographically feasible. So, you know, we've really enjoyed pairing up or having multiple author events that we would not have been doing under ordinary circumstances. So I hope we get to keep part of this when we go back to real life and, you know, no masks and travel and all the rest of it, which I, like you, believe will happen. But I think we can keep part of this technology going as well and do a mix. So I'm really grateful for that.
It's wonderful because then it allows authors who can't necessarily travel to your store to be a part of an event with your customers.
Yep. I'm sure we'll figure out some interesting ways to put it together. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. And again, I want to say that we do still have copies of The Girl from Widow Hills, which I thought was fabulous. The real high point of, when was it? July, right?
Yeah.
Was July, wasn't it?
End of June.
Oh, it was end of June. Oh, that's right. We got you right at the turn there.
Yep.
Right. And we are really looking forward to having Wendy's book here. So many thanks. Enjoy your evening. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good night. Thanks, Megan.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.